Greetings. It's your cocky co-host, Chris Castles. Zaylee's never here for the intros. It's just not convenient right now. But she's off in San Antonio partying with her husband. One of them. I don't know which one. I don't know what she's doing. But she's here in the cockpit for this interview with comedian Emma Arnold, who, oh my god, she's so funny. You gotta check out her album, Shut Up Calvin. You can get it on iTunes. She really is super great. I met her a couple years ago at a festival. She was super kind, let me stay in her hotel, didn't even know who I was. Had no idea. She might have checked references. I think she checked references. They were like, Chris, not so funny. Safe. Nice guy. But that was like 6 months before we even did any interviews. And then when she was coming through town, I was like, oh, I definitely have to have Emma Arnold on. And so it happened, and I'm glad it did. And I think you'll be glad too. So check out our conversation with Emma Arnold.
Did you read the email?
I did, yeah.
The Lord, you're the first person to
Really? No, yeah, I read it. I was rereading it in the car and was like, oh, I didn't reply because it says like send a reply for like a release. And I was like, shame on me for not replying. Oh, see, so unprofessional.
Well, we can get an audio of you releasing your rights to the, I mean, that's even better.
I hereby release my rights to this audio.
Okay.
There you go.
Hi, Zaylee. How are you?
I'm pulling it together today. Yeah, it's a rainy day here in Austin. It's been a couple rainy days in a row. It affects my life force. But I'm ironing it out. I'm happy to be meeting Emma, so.
Okay, cool. So I know Emma because I met you in Houston in February. We were on the same comedy festival. But Zaylee doesn't know you. Tell us about yourself, Emma.
I live in Idaho, and I am a comedian and a beekeeper, and I have 6 kids, but I have 3 kids and 3 stepkids, and I work the road a lot, and you know, I've been pretty busy this last couple years, and that's probably it.
Yeah, that's great. You've been busy in a really good way.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And that's it. And that's all.
Just a beekeeper, mother of 6, successful comedian. That's all, you guys.
Were you born in Idaho?
Yeah, I was born in kind of northern Idaho, up in Salmon, very rural. And then my mom moved down to Boise, Idaho, which is like the city, you know, like the capital. But my father still lives up in northern Idaho, up in the woods. And I grew up like half in the city, half very rural on a farm.
That's funny. We were talking about it last night. People that aren't from the Northwest have no idea that Idaho's not in the Midwest.
Yeah. People are always like, oh, you're from the Midwest. And I'm like, nope, we're right up against Oregon, Washington, like right smack in the West for sure.
See, I don't really know because I was raised Mormon. And so there's Utah and there's Idaho.
Yeah.
And I just assumed there were like, you know, arm in arm hanging out.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Idaho actually has more Mormons than Utah now. So we're like the new. Yeah, it's very, very Mormon, especially the southern part of Idaho. I didn't know you were raised Mormon. I wasn't raised Mormon, but all my friends growing up were Mormon, and I even converted for a couple years because I just, like, I wanted to go to the dances and hang out, so I was just like, sure, I'll do your thing. I'll be in your cult. Why not?
You were Mormon for a couple
years? Yeah, I just converted. Like, I was, like, probably 10 or 11, and I was just like, yeah, all right.
Did you get baptized?
No, I never got baptized. I got very close, and I went through the Sunday school stuff and everything, and it was kind of right towards the end where I was just like, because my aunts were gay, and there was like something that came up where they were talking about how being gay was wrong, and I was like, oh, I'm out. Like, you guys have great food, but I don't like this enough to the divinity. I'm a fan of that, but no.
That's why I don't talk to
you. You can get that anywhere.
I know. Once I realized, I was like, okay, I can make this? Never mind. Your religion's not for me.
That's basically the same relationship I have with my grandmother. I'm like, oh, you don't like Mexicans? Like my mother? Okay, cool. I'll learn to bake pies.
Yeah.
Pie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so from Idaho, still in Idaho, been in Idaho the whole time.
Yeah, well, no, actually, I moved away for about a decade. I was married to a helicopter pilot for 12 years, and he did contract work mostly, so we moved like every 3 to 6 months for like a lot of years. Like by the time my first kid was 2, he had lived in like 9 states.
Oh, cool.
And we just moved and moved and moved, and then when I got pregnant with my third, we moved back to Idaho because I was like, that's where my whole family lives there. And I was like, I need a support system. And we moved back and divorced shortly thereafter. I think probably the moving so much was what was keeping us together, honestly. And I moved back because I wanted to have like a stable place to raise my kids. And it's just, you know, it always felt like home. Like I had really started to miss it. And now, you know, people always kind of go like, how do you do comedy out of there? Like, I just do the road. Like, I don't do comedy in Boise very much, but yeah, I do the road mostly. So yeah, it's a quiet home base, basically.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Like I know that a lot of comics live in LA and then work the road, and it's like, I don't understand how you would want to go back to LA.
Yeah.
Unless you work there as well. Which yeah. I know, I guess a lot of them do, but the people that don't, that struggle, I'm like, struggle somewhere nicer to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm from LA, so I feel like I can say that.
Yeah, it's so cheap, you know, like Boise's so cheap, and it's nice and it's quiet, and I don't have the pressure. Like, I have a lot of friends like that too, who live in LA, and it's like, when you're home, you still feel like you have to do comedy all the time. Mm. And it's kind of nice to not have that pressure. Like, when I'm home, I'm just a person, you know, I can stop being a comedian for a while.
And do you think you could work the road with, I don't know how old your kids are now, but it sounds like you have a good support system there in Idaho. Like, is it possible? I'm not even just because you're a mother instead of a father, but for a parent to with six kids, like,
it would have been very difficult when my kids were little, because like they're older now and they're pretty self-sufficient. So, you know, when I'm gone, my boyfriend, he's an engineer and everything. He's very, very organized, and he has like a system, and he's like the perfect, you know, parent to be home with that many kids. But they're also really self-sufficient. Like, you know, when my sons get home from school, I have a freezer full of food that I leave, like I'll make before I go on the road, and they'll put it in, and like they get dinner ready so that when my boyfriend gets home, he just has to help serve it. We have a babysitter too, so that helps. But no, I like it. Like, honestly, before, even with just my three, when I first started comedy, I was freshly divorced, and I was trying to like figure out how to work the road. And actually, you know, being divorced, because we share custody, my ex has them every other weekend. So it would be like, I would just go on the road, and I still do that. I go on the road on his weeks so that like my boys are like kind of taken care of. But no, I think if I had been just kind of just me and my three kids living in LA, like that would be hell. That would be so, so hard to go on the road and to like try and find someone to leave them with. No,
I'm stuck on the image of your children forming like Voltron to be their own parent while you're gone.
They kind of are
standing on each other's
They're
shoulders.
Such an amazing unit, actually. They work together so well and get along so well. I come from a blended family, and when I first started dating my boyfriend, I was like, I'm not doing that shit, you know, like, because like my parents, you know, it was the 80s and they didn't do a whole lot of like integrating. Like, we just kind of lived in a house together and nobody got along. So I was really not into blending our families. But then our kids got along so well. And after we'd been together a couple years, it was like our kids who were like, can we just move in together? This is stupid. Like, switching, because we were like trying to do like one night at one house, one night at the other, and like keep it fair. And they're like, this is so dumb. And they do, like, that. Yeah, they kind of all, they are like Voltron. They take really good care of each other.
Oh, well, that's sweet, too, that they kind of blended themselves organically.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it
was.
Like, resisted it, and then they're like, no, we want
yeah,
this.
I had always been like, I'm not going to do what my parents did and, like, force my relationship onto these little people who were like, who the fuck is this guy? Yeah. You know, like, who's this stranger? Which I had a very, very nice stepdad, actually. He was really lovely. And my stepsisters were lovely, too, but... it was just a lot to kind of just be thrown into that. And, you know, in the 80s, it's not like any of us went to counseling or spent any time talking about feelings. It was just like, oh, you're a family now, you know, and it was very overwhelming as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's still impressive. Six kids and going. I mean, I have one kid and two husbands, and it's still hard for me to go to open mics. I'll find a reason to be like, oh,
yeah,
the patriarchy wants me to just stay home and watch Netflix.
Yeah, I am jealous. Like, we've been hanging out a lot in the last few months, and I think, like, man, I would like to have one girlfriend first, but then two. Oh, that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. I don't even have anyone for them to take care of.
I am very lucky, but you have to be, to make it work, you have to be like a glutton for offering emotional support.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
so, which I am. But
my marriage was open towards the end, especially. I mean, it was through the whole thing, but especially towards the end. And I had a husband and a boyfriend for quite a while. And after doing that, I was like, nope, no, thank you. Like, it is so much emotional commitment, and to make it work well, it was so exhausting. And I, mm-hmm. it's almost like, no, I own a Hitachi magic wand now, and I don't need anyone. I have six kids and a magic wand, so that's, I'm like Glinda the Good Witch.
Yeah, that's a pretty good deal. So should we run Emma through our normal
sure.
Yeah, have you seen
orientation?
The Genderbread person?
I have not seen this. Uh-uh.
It's an online resource to help people understand the binary nature, I guess, of our gender identity and expression, or that there's
non-binary.
A spectrum, that it's non-binary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny, though, because the if you look at it online, you can see that it still looks binary. It's confusing.
Yeah, we have like two arrows, but going down for these different categories. But it's just an instrument to help you talk. It's all about disrupting. It's all about problematizing. It's all about unpacking. That's what the genderbread person wants to get to. So for our guests, we'll start with gender identity. And you can see there's kind of a left to right scale of, I guess that would be asexual on the left, headed towards womanness or manness, on which you can plot yourself of how you in your head define your gender.
Oh, okay. You know, I suppose... You know, it's funny. My mother, she was molested by her father, and she was very terrified of my femininity as a little girl. And so I was dressed as a little boy most of my life, and she kind of raised me. She would, part of it was like trying to break gender norms and so, but she would really push masculine mm-hmm. identity stuff on me a lot. And like, I wasn't allowed to like play with girly things, and she would always be pushing like male things on me. And like in all the pictures when I'm little, I look like a little boy. Like I have a little bob and I'm dressed in like jeans and a flannel, you know.
Pics, or it didn't happen. I want to see.
Yeah. No, I can totally show you pics. Yeah. And then even when I got older, like she really discouraged feminine stuff, like wearing makeup and stuff and those sort of things. And it wasn't until, and so I was like a quote unquote tomboy growing up, and I was, you know, very rough and tumble. And it wasn't until I got older that I started to feel like more like, so for me, like feminine things always felt a little dirty, like wanting to wear makeup or wanting to dress up. Like I still, guilt. Yeah, like I'll still apologize to people for wearing a dress sometimes. Like, like I'll be dressed up and I'm like, I'm sorry that I look so nice. I apologize. and I will catch myself doing that. And so I think I probably, even though, you know, I obviously identify as a woman, I was raised so masculine, and you know, I played ice hockey, and I was kind of a rough kid, that I would actually identify a lot more with like sort of the traditionally male. And you know, I'm in a very male dominated career, and even I was one of those shitty girls for a long time, who like had only guy friends and was like, I don't get girls, they're weird, right?
So would you attribute your ability to communicate in that masculine way or in that men's world too? Directly to that, which is essentially kind of an abusive, I mean, that your mother did that, would you say that affected you, or that's the positive from it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that is definitely part of it. Even now, I feel like I'm pretty good at getting through to bro-y guys and making them be like, yeah, maybe I am a feminist, you know, like, because I can kind of connect on like a masculine level. And that also, like, having three sons, I definitely spend a lot of time thinking about like men's issues and the plight of men and things like that more than like if I hadn't been raised like that. I guess it's a funny thing because I've never really thought about it or identified that before, but about being raised so masculine. But yeah, it probably does help. It probably helps that, you know, I was always the girl, and I hate to say this stuff because like, now I'm like, fuck you. But like, I was always the girl. It's like, you're not like other girls. Like, you're, you know, you're just one of the guys. And
yeah, I had that as well, where you sort of carry the banner of the masculine, I don't know, the superiority of like masculine modes of expression and of, you know, oh, like beautiful things are stupid and silly.
Yeah. And oh, you're not emotional like a girl, you know, you like guys would say that to me. Yeah. You don't like to talk about stuff. And so I did definitely carry that banner for a long time. But now as I've gotten older, I think I've started really to appreciate and cultivate the feminine side of my life and to, you know, to feel okay with the parts of that that are really beautiful and, you know, to have a lot more women friends and to appreciate that feminine energy a lot more. So,
and maybe just like telling people they're welcome for your dress as opposed to apologizing.
Yeah. I know Dave Ross, actually, I showed up to UCB and I was dressed really, really nicely in like this beautiful dress for this show. And he was like, you look gorgeous. You look great in that dress. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm really over. And he was like, no, thank you. Thank you for wearing that. And I was so uncomfortable. Like I felt so self-conscious that I was dressed like a girl, quote unquote, you know, and afterward, I really thought about it in my car that I was like, there were other women in dresses that like, I was like, you look nice. And that was fine for them. But for me, it's like an inherent, like, I'm dressed like a girl today. I apologize for that. Yeah.
So is your mother still around? Has she been a part of this unfolding? Where does she stand on it?
Yeah. And we've actually very recently had some very in-depth. My mother is, my family is Swedish and they are very Norwegian and like they don't talk about anything ever. There's like no like feelings are stuffed deep down into your heart pocket and never talked about again.
That's a Swedish Norwegian kind of
thing. Yeah, okay. And even
it's
my
cold place.
It's cold. Okay. We're cold people. And I've had people like tell me like you're very cold. And I kind of have to work against that natural Swedish tendency to be very, you know, to be distant and stuff. But I recently had talked to her. So like 3 months ago, I actually finally told her and the rest of my family that I had also been molested as a kid. And it like opened up. I had avoided it for so long because I knew it would break her heart. And because she tried so desperately to protect me from men, but she just couldn't. And so I talked to her about that and it sort of like burst open our relationship and we started having all these conversations and she told me that all this stuff about why she dressed me like a boy and why she was so overprotective. And it was like for the first time, like I understood all these motivations for why I was raised so oddly, you know, like so specifically masculine. And yeah, it's kind of blown open a lot of that. And now it's really sweet actually. Cause like now she'll see pictures of me and stuff in a dress and she'll be like, you look so beautiful. You're just such a natural beauty, you know? Aww. Like, so I think it's kind of changed things for her. Like she isn't as scared for me to be out. And I totally get it. Like part of her, for her was like, if you're a woman out in the world, you're so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so she always tried to masculinize me so that I wouldn't be so vulnerable. And I was small too, you know, I'm a small person. And so I think she always just tried to like toughen me up so that I wouldn't be a weak girl, you know, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. This story is super interesting to me. And obviously that talk, maybe that didn't happen just at one talk and that was like a process you guys went through. But I'm curious because I know that she probably experienced a lot of emotions, but was there guilt about having failed in a way?
Having all these things
she tried to do and then it still didn't stop.
She was devastated, which was part of the reason I hadn't told her like my whole life. So I was like really systematically and terribly sexually abused by my biological father for like most of my young life. And so she had protected me from men, like from everyone else. And like, I wasn't allowed to do sleepovers, you know, like, and she was always like, be careful of that coach. You know, she was always warning me against men, but it was like the call was coming from inside the house kind of thing. Like she didn't realize that that was going on. And then after they split, she was still sending me to my father's in the summer. And she has so much guilt about the fact that she continued after they split to send me to my father's every summer to like kind of endure more of this abuse that otherwise had like kind of broken the chain. So she was wrecked. I mean, and that was like, I had protected her from that because I didn't want her to feel guilty over that. Like I'm not upset with her or angry with her in any way. And she did. She like cried and cried and cried and was so, she just was so heartbroken. And it's also a weird thing. Like I've done a ton of EMDR and like therapy for it. So it's passed for me. Like it's kind of, it's not a hot little coal for me anymore in the same way. So it was like weird. Cause I was sort of comforting her in this thing where I'm like, hey, by the way, these terrible things happened to me. And she, and I'm through a lot of it. And she is like brand new for her.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And it also like, she never dealt with her own abuse. She never dealt with the how abusive my father was. So it was like very layered for her.
Do you want to just quickly explain for anybody who might not know what EMDR is or what?
Sure. Yeah. It's eye movement, reprocessing and desensitization. And it's basically a kind of therapy they use to treat PTSD in combat vets and other people. And you hold these two little paddles in your hand that like make like a little buzzing like feeling, and they kind of go like left to right, left to right. And what it does is you don't have to do it in detail, but you bring up a memory, especially like a body memory, and it moves a memory from your amygdala up to your hippocampus. So where your memory is, if you're traumatized by something, if you have PTSD, a memory is stored instead of in your memory bank, it's stored in your body, in your amygdala. So that like, if you've ever had a fight or flight response over something that you're like, where the fuck did that come from? Like, why am I feeling panic in this moment? That's an amygdala memory. And so by taking something and processing it from the left to the right side of your brain at the same time, it helps you process this memory up into your frontal cortex. And it's so insanely effective. Like I've done tons of therapy before, but this is the stuff that actually moves it out of your body and makes it so that like, you know, there would be things like I would have weird body responses to like to random utensils or things like, or phrases where I would feel panic related to the abuse I felt, where now I don't have that body response at all.
Oh, that's super fascinating. Is there an app for that?
No, but actually you can do it to yourself. If you put your hands like, you know, like how you make a dove.
Yeah.
So put your hands in the dove shape on your chest, on your collarbone. And then close your eyes and you start to think of that memory in, like, you know, just sort of a very basic, not too much in depth. And then you alternate tapping your collarbones left to right, just slowly, while you take deep breaths. And you just sort of work yourself through start to finish that memory. And that's a way to kind of do it as a meditation yourself. I use that for meditation techniques quite a bit.
I'm probably going to do that.
Oh, it's very comforting. I do it before shows sometimes. Like, if I have that feeling, you know how sometimes before, like, you go on stage, you start to have that, like, I might barf, you know, like,
yeah.
I'll stand in the back and just do that and be like, you're okay. You're fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to die up there. So what else matters, you know?
Yeah. It's a trick.
Yeah. That's handy.
Yeah.
Well, that's Emma's gender identity.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
A long answer.
No, that's beautiful because, you know, like, you basically, you just sort of walked us through in a holistic way what the little genderbread person tries to, like, break apart into a bunch of separate stories. I guess, though, it is worth, though, asking you down at the bottom here where we have these scales of your attraction, which they separate out, they distinguish into sexual attraction versus romantic attraction. If you would plot yourself, I mean, you joked about, oh, I don't need anybody. But if you want to be more specific...
I think sexually I've always been, I remember, like, one of my first crushes was a friend of mine, this girl, and when we used to play Pretty Spanking Princesses together.
Whoa.
I can't believe I just told you that.
Yes.
And we had this great game, and then I moved away. And I was in love with her for years after that. Like, I would think about her all the time. And so I do think sexually I've always been very middle of the road, like very bisexual. And romantically, I've always gravitated more towards men. I think romantically, like, when I have a deep seated infatuation with someone, it's always been a man. Like, women, I feel sexually attracted to, but romantically, I don't know, I feel more like peers. You know, like, mm-hmm. I don't have that same infatuation with women, whereas with men, you know, that's kind of where my infatuation goes.
The name of your special isn't Pretty Spanking Princesses?
It should be. Pretty Spanking Princesses.
Name of your fan club.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I am going to start a fan club, Pretty Spanking Princesses. That's great.
I think it's fascinating how much even, like, comedians, and all three of us are comedians here, even us who share so much about ourselves still have things that we feel like, oh, I can't believe... Like, oh, I'm about to share this?
Yeah.
No, oh, like, yeah.
There's so many things that we don't. So you can only imagine the person who doesn't practice expressing these things, how much they have to unbear from themselves or, like, unburden themselves from. Even something silly like that. There's something to that, right, that you're embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to
me. Yeah, that, like, it'll surprise me sometimes because I'm so not shy in general, you know, with, like, the details of my life, like, I'm so open that when something has that little tickle of, like, yuck, no, where you're like, oh, I don't want to tell people that. That's always a funny, like, yeah, it's like, oh, there's something. Cause, like, you almost run out of things where that you don't want to talk about. And those are always the things that whenever I've been like, I don't want to talk about that on stage, those are the things that get the biggest laugh.
Oh, for sure. Because for me, it's like, because everybody I think is trying to hold those same things back. And that's like takes, you know, not consciously, but a fair amount of energy to just for the whole culturally to pretend that children aren't sexual, mm-hmm. that, like, little girls don't have these fantasy games with other little girls. I'm like, so there's a part of me that's always secretly wondering, well, I spend a lot of time just not thinking about it at all. But then secretly wondering, like, am I weird in that way? Because the girls that I was playing with, like, it was normal to us at the time. Like, mm-hmm. some part of us knew, like, oh, you're not supposed to let adults see this.
Yeah.
You know, like, as we, you know, go from, like, playing house to sort of straddling each other, you know, that, like, that's something you wouldn't want anybody to walk in on.
Yeah.
But surely we weren't the only ones, you know?
Yeah, I've wondered that, too. Because I was molested so young, I've been like, did I play those games because I was hypersexualized really young, and so those were the things that I was like, oh, this is normal shit, or was everybody just doing that stuff? Like, I've wondered that too.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody was doing it, but I was also molested, so I don't know.
everybody
was
so.
A little bit, yeah, maybe that's the other thing. Maybe we're all like, is everybody molesting little kids?
I feel so left out.
Oh,
well, you know, this kind of is going back too, but this isn't a thought I had. it's interesting to me that your mother had all this like shame and unresolved stuff. Like she didn't go to therapy. And I know that has a lot to do with the era, mm-hmm. the time, which is exciting now that there's more available. But it is interesting to me, was that unresolved? Did that lead her to be with someone like your biological father?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so in a way that there's like a cycle in there. And that
definitely.
That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, that they say that like trauma actually changes you on a genetic level. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very true that it fucks with your picker. You know, it definitely messes with you and makes you seek out. I mean, I ended up with someone abusive, mm-hmm. not sexually abusive, but, you know, I had sons also. So maybe that's even part of it. I'm not saying my ex is a molester, but like I think that you definitely end up seeking, even though you do your best to not, you end up seeking out that relationship kind of over and over. And like I'm with someone who's very gentle and kind now, but I even see it now in the men I'm attracted to a lot of times. I'm like, that's a brute. Look at why are you like, oh, he looks like he'd be mean to me. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
because you want to heal it, don't you think? Like resolve it?
Somehow? No, I think honestly for me, there's like a very deep, sick, self-destructive part that's like, yeah, let's just finish this, you know?
Me
like,
too.
Yeah. Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's me. And that's why I am avoiding relationships 100% now and trying to keep everything touch and go. And I always lay everything out as much as possible to be like, this is who I am. This is where I'm at, because I need that space, because I know that I'm not ready to like the, I don't trust myself to choose the right person.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that I'm good with myself yet.
Yeah.
Even to be able to do that.
So is it fair or useful to say that people, I mean, I guess this is just maybe what you'd call masochism, but that you can derive pleasure from that type of friction with someone, not just like, yeah. oh, P and the V friction, but like emotional, oh, yeah. psychological friction.
P and your psychological V.
That's actually something, a rule that I have like given myself, and I've passed it on to other people who I know, because I have like sexually, I have a very deep masochistic side, and I've been like, it's okay to be with someone. Like sexual masochism is okay, but emotional masochism is like, it's like the red no-go zone for me. Like it's a boundary. Like I don't allow any emotional masochism in my life now, which is still something I gravitate towards. Like I end up getting into friendships where I'm like, this person's not very nice to me. And then I'm like, no, that's your responsibility. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to allow that. So yeah, I think it's, you can heal from, you can find relationships like, you know, I think it's BDSM can be a very useful tool for like healing those and like reenacting those situations in a way that you have control of and that you can derive pleasure from. But I think for me, emotional masochism is a big, like a line drawn there.
Or like emotional healing then becomes a source or a basis for relationships in the same way. So like, mm-hmm. instead of being attracted to relationships that drive me deeper, now I'm like attracted to friendships that mm-hmm. help heal me out. And I feel the same about the both of you. When I met you, it was like, oh, this is a safe place for me to verbalize all this stuff I'm going through.
Mm-hmm. And well, yeah, I mean, I guess maybe that's my version of, I don't have the masochism thing really, but I do have the, like, I am drawn to, and this hasn't been all my life, this, and honestly, like, becoming a mother has kind of heightened this, or at least brought it to my attention, the pleasure that I derive from nurturing, where I, like, am really drawn to someone who's maybe at least initially like way too hard on themselves or just like stuck in a rut, you know, and be like, oh, I just want to shower you with like attention and validation.
Thank yeah, you. I have that same. I'm like, oh my gosh, are you a hurt bird? I will take care of you.
Yeah,
I've got
like,
you.
You know, but yeah. but not just like that can't be the only thing. You know, it's yeah. also got to be like, oh, but you're also brilliant and like
yeah.
have. Like, I love how you smell and, you know, like all those, the physical stuff, you know, having yeah. to be there. But that's like a really big turn on mm-hmm. is like, oh, like, let me like put some magic dust on you because kissing frogs. I
as
guess,
a spokesperson for your Legion of Broken Men, I say thank you. Thank you, Zaylee.
It's literally a pleasure.
I have started to lean back even from that because I realized for me, it's a way to like not give myself self-care and I'll like shower someone else with attention if that person also like is kind to me back, then that's more of an acceptable situation. But like a lot of times I would shower people with affection who were not, who wouldn't return that in any way, you know, like who were not kind or supportive back to me. And I've been very careful in the last couple of years to be like, to try to direct that love toward myself a lot more and to start to take care of myself.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Complete the loop. If they're not giving anything back, you know, if they're not making you feel like a goddess, then like it's probably not your consort.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So sort of off topic, but birth control, I especially like to ask the lady guests. Actually, I especially like to ask the male guests. Is how, I like the stumped looks on their faces.
Asking a gay man has been the best so far.
He's like, I don't care.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know. I don't deal with it. Yeah. It's not a problem for me.
It's fine for other people. Birth control, experiences, preferences, gripes?
I don't have to use anything now because my boyfriend has a vasectomy, which is very nice. I tried to get an IUD after I had kids, but they couldn't get one in because my cervix was so mangled by my kids' gigantic heads that they were like, nope, this is just not happening. It's
mangled.
I had a really, really bad labor experience, which is a whole other podcast, really. But it tore really bad. My cervix tore. And they were like, yeah, you just can't get an IUD in there. It's just not going to happen. So I've tried a couple different times, but it was really painful and I couldn't do it. So I didn't have a very good experience with that. Every time I've tried like the pill, I've gone really bananas crazy. Like it's really brought out like weird bipolar mania craziness in me.
Videos or it didn't happen.
Like I just didn't. And I've tried it a few different times and it's really fucked with my hormones and made me like feel real nuts. So I just haven't been able to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to do anything now, which is nice.
It's good that you like because I hear women talk about that, you know, that the pill has affected their mood. And I have gone off and on with the pill. I was put on it as a teenager because I had amenorrhea. Like I just wouldn't menstruate on my own, so it was like, oh, we'll use synthetic hormones to just make sure that you're at least like shut, otherwise you're at risk for endometriosis and other things. But looking, I didn't think of it at the time cause I was so young and it was like, oh, well, you're a moody teenager and of course you're in your 20s and you know, but looking back, yeah, the times that I was on the pill were the times that I really struggled with depression and briefly my freshman year of college, like a very severe eating disorder where I was like so depressed that I just like had such indigestion and low like life force that it was like a pain in the ass to even eat, you know? So I really wonder if it isn't much worse than...
Yeah, I was on... I had such heavy periods as a... I started my period when I was 11, and I had such heavy periods that... and I was anemic, and, you know, I weighed, like, 60 pounds. I was just, like, this tiny little thing. And so they put me on the shot, the Depo-Provera, and I was on that until I was 20, and... After they finally took me off of it, they were like, oh, you're really only supposed to be on this for like a couple years and not, you're like, this is not actually very safe.
That is terrible.
And looking back, I realized that it fucked up my hormones and it made me, I sometimes wonder if it contributed to how like manic and hypersexual I was as a teenager, you know, just, I mean, maybe it wouldn't have made any difference, but it definitely, after I went off of it, I felt like a completely different person.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, maybe it slowed you down. That was the thing. Yeah, it would have been way worse.
Maybe, yeah.
You'll never know. And that's what's weird, I think, about putting adolescents or teenagers on hormonal birth controls. It's like, well, this is like the body's changing. And it is like everything about that period of life is getting to know yourself, you know. So it's not really a very well-controlled experiment if you've got...
No.
But people have to make hard choices about that, I guess. But I'm happy for you that you can raw dog it now without...
Yeah, it's very nice.
that's great. So I'd love to ask you also if you had an idea of sex before you heard about... Or before it was confirmed. Did you have any childish imaginings?
Well, no. And that's something I've spent the last, actually, like, kind of year mourning is because I was... molested so severely, so young. I mean, really young, from like probably a year old on to when I was, you know, eight or eight-ish. I never, like, I didn't have any virginities to lose, you know? And like, sex was never new. It was never something I got to just have on my own and like experience in sort of real time. And I, like, I have been kind of spending some time like mourning that, because it is, it's like, it was never fresh for me. And especially because like the stuff that happened to me was so extreme, like even the most extreme stuff, like later when I was really getting into, you know, some kinkier shit, I was like, I've already done all this horrible shit, you know? Like, so that's definitely been something that's been hard to sort of come to grips with, and you know, was a little heartbreaking in some ways.
And your mom talked to you a lot about the dangers of men and maybe like a predatory way. Did she ever give you a more conventional talk about sex, or present it as like, oh, this could be a positive thing?
Sex was so weird in my house, because so my mom was like a hippie, and like my lesbian aunts lived with us, and sex was this cool freewheeling, like free love thing. And, you know, we had like the joy of sex and like our bodies ourselves, and like you could ask anything, and there was like nothing that was, everything was very cool and groovy, except specifically not for me. So like if I asked my mother something about sex, because she had all this deep seated shame about sex, and she was raised Lutheran, and she was, you know, just, my mom is very prudish anyway. Like it was a weird thing. So it was, I always kind of got the vibe of like, sex is this cool, groovy thing, but not for you. And like when I first lost my virginity and was like trying to talk to her, like I was honest with her, she like shut down and she didn't talk to me for like 3 weeks.
Whoa.
Because she just like was so upset. And I was 14, you know, so I was very young, and I was trying to talk to her about it. And she was just like, she could not talk to me. And she was just like, I'm so disappointed in you. So it was so, and a lot of things. And like when I started my period, like I went to her and like, you know, this is very free love hippie household where you'd think like they'd have like a moon ceremony and burn my first, you know, pad. But, and that's how my sisters and my aunts were. They were like, oh my God, you're our moon sister, you know? But my mother was like, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Ugh.
And she was like really upset that I had started my period. So there was always this sort of specifically, sex is great, but for you, it's inherently dirty, you know? Man. So it was always very confusing.
Shame.
Yeah.
There's a lot, like, that whole mixed messages through the mom. My mom, you know, I was always so grossed out when my mom would try to talk to me about anything. I just was not at home really with the idea of being sexual, probably part, at least in part, because of the way I grew up, and also I was like a little intellectual kid who was just like, ugh. But she was really wanted to like push me into like the feminine, kind of opposite of you. I was between two boys. She really was excited to have a little girl. I remember her forcibly plucking my eyebrows when I was in high school, because she could not deal with my fucking face looking au natural anymore, and it hurt. But when I shaved my legs though, and when I bought pretty underwear, that's when she went really cold and was really quote unquote disappointed in me. And I wonder if, because there's the feminine that's like empowering, because this will get you access and this will get your influence, and it's the power of like being pleasant to look at. And then there's the actual having sex aspect that probably both of our moms maybe felt was, or associated with, the victimization of the female experience. You know, you shave your legs, that's different from plucking your eyebrows, because that means somebody's going to be touching your legs.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't allowed to shave my legs. And in junior high, I was like bullied terribly because of it, because I was like the last girl in, I think it was like eighth grade, ninth grade. And I was the only girl that didn't shave her legs. And everybody just teased me awful. Like, but my mom, she would not allow it. Like, it was so upsetting to her, the idea. But like, not the same, not quite the same, you know, level of like when I started wearing makeup, she was like, oh, you don't need that stuff on your face. But like shaving your legs, yeah, it was like, that's sexual. That's different. You
did
know?
She shave her legs?
No, she still doesn't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. No. Nope, nothing. She doesn't
just
shave.
Never?
I remember her shaving like for her wedding, maybe.
So you know, that's like her just like shutting it down?
Yeah. Well, and that, my mom dresses very masculine. She wears like carpenter jeans and like flannels. And she definitely leans way far back from any femininity. Like, uh-huh. My mom does not, she does not, like, she, I've seen her in a skirt, or I've seen her in a dress a handful of times, and I've seen her in a skirt, you know, maybe 20 times in my life. Like, she like leans way far back from any femininity.
Ugh,
well,
see,
I mean,
see, this just, I know this is a broad stroke, but I want to say this. It just says so much about like cyclical damage between the sexes, that like the way that someone victimizes someone else, then it turns it fucks everything up, because it's like, now you have your mother, who I assume is a beautiful woman, who's like covering up her femininity and is ashamed of it, which is just damaging for all of us.
Yeah.
So it just like works, like abuse works to abuse yourself in a way.
Well, yeah.
I know that's
armoring.
A broad stroke. I know that's.
Because, I mean, there are a lot of women who choose to like engage their femininity in other ways apart from just like grooming the body is kind of like a feminine engagement, and that's great. But I will tell you, like, I've always preferred how it feels to have a smooth leg, and I've gone both ways. But like midway through my 30s now, I'm like, I'm getting sick of doing this, and like there's no way out.
Yeah, it is so time consuming. It is a funny thing too, because it's, you definitely, the level of intensity of how much you get harassed by men is very closely tied to how much time you spend grooming. So there have been times in my life where I'm like, if I just grew out my unibrow and stop shaving and, you know, just wore cardigans, I'd probably get left alone. But like, if I wear red lipstick, shut it down. Like every dude on the street's like, hey, oh, monkey feelings. You know?
I think it's just so funny. Like the work that you put in equals the amount of harassment.
Yeah.
So you're like working to be harassed.
But you'll get harassed the other way. You know what I mean? Like,
oh,
if
for
you
not doing it.
Yeah. If you, it's just, I don't know.
But there's power in it too. Like being really attractive. You, like you said, you get rewards and power from that. So it's like, there's definitely a trade-off, you know?
For sure. Yeah. I don't know anything about it.
Well, that's an aspect. That's an interesting aspect of sexism as well, I feel like, where women are shamed for using the leverage that they have as sexual beings in a sexual world,
yeah,
to be seductive and be like, this is my way of negotiating, this is my way of managing relationships, instead of swinging a dick around and being do as I say, to look at you like I know the good of your heart because I believe in it, and like to know that you like to look at me and be like, hey, let's make this work, you know? And that's somehow seen as manipulative,
yeah,
instead of just managing things, you know, whether or not you're sucking dicks. I feel like there's that very strong judgment against beautiful women who know that they're beautiful, who enjoy their beauty and allow others to enjoy their beauty. Yeah.
There's a lot of rules around like how you're allowed to be beautiful. Like you can be beautiful, but you can't have spent any time on it. Like you can wear makeup, but it needs to look like you didn't wear makeup. I always think it's funny when somebody's like, you look beautiful without makeup. Like, do you know how much fucking time goes into looking beautiful without makeup? Like there's a whole lot of waxing that happens and exfoliating.
So
it's not effortless by any means.
I experienced this. So recently I went home with a woman at night and I was drunk and I said to her, hey, I'm going to go. Normally I would try and kiss someone at this point in the evening, but we just met. And that was my way of saying, like, I want to kiss you, and I don't want to leave here you thinking that I didn't want to do it. So I said it, and she said, hey, can I change in front of you? And then she got completely naked and then handed me what she was changing into and then changed into what she was going to wear while I kept talking. And then she hugged me and said, thank you for allowing me to be naked in front of you. You don't know how important it is for a woman to feel comfortable naked in front of a man. And I've told this story several times to almost every guy. Goes, oh man, she's just trying to, you know, she's just trying to fuck you over. She knows what she's doing. She gave me a rose. And, you know, they're like, oh, that's, she's just manipulative. And I'm like, what? Like, it made me second guess it. Is this woman playing me? Or if she is, does it matter? Like, right. Isn't that part of it? Like, I'm so thankful for that. That was the hottest moment ever. I'm
even
in love with the
person. Even
if
she's not going to fuck you, you got to see her naked. So,
oh, yeah, and I did. And it isn't even that. It is like, I like how, like, I walked away from there, like, with, you know, like, feeling amazing. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that it was, there was theatrics involved, like, why would you, it's like having a magician show their, I don't want to see, but I'm glad it seemed for me and special for me.
Yeah.
But I feel like guys, oh, she's just doing, and I'm like, what?
A lot of, you know, guys would be like, you know, why do women make it so complicated? Like, why can't we just fuck? And it's like, does everybody really want to live in that world where you can go to like a drive-through fuck? Like, I think people like a little, and it's not that women don't like sex or that women don't like to get off or that women, you know, are less sexual. I think it's just that the, you know, the whole sexual experience has a bigger range for feminine, I should say, people, not strictly women, but where it involves like the story. It involves like this psychological foreplay that is what sends the blood yeah. to the right places of the body so that then the body's in the mood. You know, if you want to skip all of that foreplay, you're going to have to work harder. You got to get the blood flowing there somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I always like a little power dynamic in my foreplay, you know? And so something like that, like, that's hot. Being like, I just undressed in front of you. What do you think about that? That's, I don't think that that's manipulative. It's playful.
Playful,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Important distinction. do you remember your first impression of a real life penis?
I do, but it's pretty horrific. So it's all my stuff. All my firsts are like, oh, I feel really bad telling you guys.
When you led with your story, I was like, well, this kind of kills a lot of the questions.
No, I'm sorry.
So when did you lose your virginity?
Over 10 virginity. How about?
No, but I think that this is important too, because like part of like the point of the podcast is we want to show that people have all sorts of different stories, and this whole idea that there's a right way or a real way to like discover your sexuality is just kind of like something that makes it easier to not talk about mm-hmm. how it actually goes down, which is all sorts of ways, and some of them are fucking tragic.
Yeah, a lot of mine are. if we're not going to count sort of the stuff that happened to me when I was younger, penises were kind of always around because we lived in kind of a commune feel. So people were often naked and like we went hot springs. Idaho has like more hot springs than anywhere in the country. And so we were always at some hot springs with a bunch of wieners out. And
just a bachelorette party at the hot springs.
All the time.
There's wieners everywhere.
There's cacks everywhere. I do remember, like, and I just remember being at a hot spring and being kind of, like, across the pool from, you know, one of my uncles or a cousin or somebody standing, and he had his penis out and he was talking. And I remember thinking what a funny-looking, odd thing they were. Like, I just remember it, like, and I remember thinking, like, it's like a Muppet. Because it has all this hair on top and then it's just hanging down. And he was circumcised, which circumcised penises always look so naked to me. Because now I've only really been with uncircumcised guys for a very long time now. So a circumcised penis, I'm always like, oh, the whole thing's showing. It's just all out. Oh, my gosh. And I just remember it just kind of sitting there. And, you know, he was just
steam rising
and just being like, boy, it's just all the way out there. So exposed. It's just, you know, yeah, it's kind of hanging.
Yeah. I remember I definitely thought of like, what is it? Chicken giblets? Is that what the thing that you take
giblets?
Out? Or the turkey giblets, is it? That you take those out? That's like, yeah, that's...
That's the neck and the gizzard.
Yeah.
So flattering.
It's a cock, you know?
So flattering.
Well, it's not that it can't be beautiful, but I don't know. Maybe takes some time to warm up to. A flaccid dick does not inspire usually a lot of erotic awakening.
I've been doing a joke about, because I get a lot of pictures of flaccid dicks on the internet.
My God.
Like, and it's supposed to be like this threatening thing from like Trump people who are like, fuck you, what about this? And I've been doing this joke about how it's like a little bit like someone handing you a dead mouse, like where you're just like, what am I supposed to, like, it's just soft.
Throw it away.
It's just soft and like really vulnerable, and you're just like, oh, there you go.
Wait, let's back up. You're getting hate mail of people sending you flaccid dick pics?
Not now, but back in June, I was on Sirius Radio, and I was on a pretty, you know, popular show. And I said some things against Trump and against a radio host who has since lost his job, whose name I do not want to invoke because I don't have to go through this all again. But he sent a bunch of his followers after me and was like, get this bitch. And they started tweeting, like, threatening stuff against my kids and, like, rape threats and stuff. But then in the mix of that, they were sending pictures of their flaccid dicks, which I just thought was, like, so funny because I was like, there's nothing less threatening than a flaccid dick. You know, like, you're like, oh, thanks. It was so – and it was just – like, I got a lot of erect ones, too, which those have a little power behind them, at least. But, like, a flaccid penis is like, oh, you're precious.
It's such,
it's
like,
so random.
The nature of trolling. It would make sense their weapon is their flaccid penis.
Yeah.
It's so appropriate.
Yeah. And it was funny, too, because I was like, like, I don't know. I feel like you can get a pretty good impression of me pretty fast from like my Twitter or my website or whatever. And I'm like, what about me says I would be that I would be disgusted by a penis, you know, that I'd be like, oh God, all these dicks, you know, I just look through them curiously. Like, oh, there's another one. Like it's just interesting to me.
Them and make like a mosaic of you making yeah. like a peace sign or something.
Yeah, we could have a gallery opening of like the hate mail cocks that
I haven't been getting as many. I installed the blockchain on Twitter and now those guys can't in mass, like those guys can't contact me the same way.
Because it's unnecessary negativity. Yeah, as fun as it might be, sometimes it's got to be taxing.
Yeah, it was wearing, and especially because they were doing some really gross shit, like sending me pictures of my kids with like threats written on them. And
oh
stuff.
God!
And I ended up having to like you know file reports and do a bunch of shit, and I was just like, I don't want to deal with this. I just Twitter's an entertainment tool. Like I don't want to. I'm not fucking with this stuff anymore. So yeah.
Good for you. That's why when this podcast goes up, we talked about just not having the comments on. Like, oh, you can write us a letter, but I don't really want to see.
I don't allow comments on anything anymore. I don't care what you think.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you. This is not a conversation. Yeah. I'm a performer. I don't need your feedback in real time. I don't allow comments on shit.
We're going to take that sound bite and make you sound really good. I don't give a fuck what you think. Come to my show.
Emma Arnold.
That takes a steel stomach, though. I mean, like, that's how creepy. It's one of those things, you know, because I started doing stand-up after I had a baby as well, and I had already, you know, not egregiously, but put her out there, you know, because this, like, especially I was a stay-at-home mom in the beginning, and social media is, like, how you stay in people's lives, or at least try. You know, and like my life was my child. So there are pictures of my child out there. And then I started thinking, like, am I like robbing her of some privacy? But I just feel like we don't really live in that world anymore where mm-hmm. people have it at all. But that's out there for, you know, creeps and psychos to do what they want.
Yeah, it was the first time I was ever scared. You know, like I've dealt with waves of crazy hate before, and I've been threatened, and like I've been threatened in person, you know, and had things happen. But it was the first time I was really genuinely afraid, where like I set my Facebook to private, and I like kind of shut everything down for a while, because like they'll move on fairly fast, and they did within you know 3 weeks they had moved on to the next person. But it was like the first time that I was really like, oh, this job is kind of dangerous, and I went through and like. Protected all my website stuff and made sure that my address wasn't anywhere, you know, and it was a good wake up call that maybe happened early on before I get, you know, famous, or hopefully, you know, but like it was a little scary. It was definitely like because I do podcasts with my kids and stuff, and it was like, oh yeah, am I exposing them to danger in doing this? So it was pretty scary.
Yeah, good that it happened early on, because it seems like it could drive you insane.
Yeah.
At a bigger level.
Yeah.
Like plagues of locusts.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, millions of dick pics.
Soft dick locusts.
Plague of soft dicks. So in a word, what gets you off?
We'll just go for it. Totally spanking. It's 100% spanking. Like, that's my go-to for porn. Like, when I'm just like, you have 3 minutes to masturbate before you have to go take a shower. It's always like, yep, this, you know, I have a particular, like, set of videos that are my faves. And it's always some sort of power dynamic with spanking. That's always it.
So that brings some, now pretty spanking princesses?
Yeah, no, that's why I was in love with that girl for most of my young life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
One time she invited me out to coffee as an adult, and I was like, I don't think I'm ready for that. Like, I'm not ready to see you again. It was totally like.
Because the whole time beneath every conversation is the subtext of.
Yeah, for me. Because like I think princesses. For her, like she probably, like there was no connection to it. It was just like, oh, we were kids together. And I'm like, I love you.
Do you think that would like fuck stuff up for you if you felt a romantic attraction to a woman?
No, I don't think it would fuck stuff up right now, yeah, it would. My boyfriend is very monogamous, and his ex-wife left him for a woman. So it's kind of a sore, tender little tooth. Yeah. Okay. If I was like, I kind of am, and in fact, people have even joked like, "Oh, if you were to make out with a woman," I'm like, "I think it would be worse." Than if I was having an affair with a man, honestly. Like, I think it would be more heartbreaking. Especially in an emotional affair with a woman, I think would devastate him. Mm. Like, it would be really hard. And so I'm careful about that a lot of times with women. Like, I kind of keep a distance, like, to make sure that doesn't happen.
Good to know. Yeah. I'm noting all of this stuff for our future friendship. So the spanking porn, though, is it women getting spanked by men?
No, primarily women, but male or female spanker. Like I go back and forth depending on how I feel about the patriarchy in that day. Then I also watch men. Like I am a big fan of pegging porn. Like when I'm feeling very mad at male comedians, I watch a bunch of pegging porn and then feel better. And I'll be like, yeah, well, fuck you.
And you masturbate to it. It's like a sexual
release. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I love it. And same, like the male spanking porn. I'm totally fine with that. I watch a lot of gay porn. I love watching two rough looking cops fuck each other. Fuck yeah. That's my...
I just imagine your search engine being filled of like comedians' names, like look-alike
yeah.
porn.
Yeah, exactly.
You need specific
it's comforting. Pegging. If only we had time for another project, Chris. So much on our plate. All right, well, let's get to the meat of the show. Do you want to start us with a good cock or a bad cocktail?
Let's start with a bad cocktail. So I had a partner who was interested in having a threesome with another man. And for, like, you know, no-name purposes, we'll just call them gay man, straight man. And so I had a straight partner who was interested in doing a threesome. And I had a friend who had been somewhat attracted to me but very attracted to my partner, who wanted to do a threesome with us, and so we decided to have a threesome. And I haven't had a ton of very successful threesomes. I've had a lot of waves of threesomes where you're like, well, we all tried, and that was, you know what, good for us. Where somebody's like, I feel weird, I'm gonna go, you know, like threesomes. I have always been a little fraught for me, but usually male-male seems for me to have gone a lot better than female-female-male. I don't know if that would be true now, but, well, no, honestly, if I was going to be with a woman now, I'd be like, I would not include a man in it. I'd be like, no, thanks. We're good. We've got this, the two ladies. But so we started having this threesome, and it seemed to be going okay at first, and it was sexy and stuff. But every time I would touch my gay friend, he would lose his erection. Like every time I would be like going down on him or fooling around with him, or he tried to have sex with me, he would immediately lose his erection. Whereas with my partner, he was like rock hard and so into it. And it really became this like, it started to really affect my self-esteem, because I was like, it was literally like if I touched his dick, it would just die. And then I'd be like, oh, I guess here, you do this instead. And then he would be back to it. While at the same time, my straight partner was clearly very, very, because he had been like, I don't want to do anything with him. I just want to watch him fuck you. And like, we can all fool around. But then which never is fun in a threesome. I think a straight guy threesome is one of my, like an uber straight dude in a threesome with another man is one of the most uncomfortable situations I've ever been in. But it was clear as this threesome was going on that he was sort of discovering this very bisexual desire.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was like awakening for him while at the same time being covered in shame. So as our, like my gay friend, who's very, very into him, starts giving him a blowjob, and it's like clearly amazing and he's really into it. He's at the same time having a really hard time, and he kind of starts verbally abusing both of us, and like not in a fun power dynamic, like you're both such bad kittens type way, but like in this very kind of genuine, like, you guys are gross sluts way, and I like, I'm not like you guys, this is your thing. And it was a real disaster. Like the whole threesome was like, I think we all left being like, ugh. And like we remained and we talked about it afterwards, and actually we had sex, I think, I don't know, maybe 10, the three of us, like 10 more times after that.
Did it get better or did it get worse?
It got better, but I always felt like there was a very weird, and my gay friend, he told me that like he was attracted to me, but like when we would be fooling around, he would be feeling like he was betraying the gay community, and like that it was like compromising his gayness. And so he would get these like double thought, like these layers of thought of like, I shouldn't be doing this with a woman. While
so the blood leaves the cock, goes to the brain.
Yeah. And he's like, and while at the same time, my straight partner is like, oh, what's all this gay shit happening? Ah, I like this. What's happening? What does this mean? And like, we all talked about it and we tried to work through it. And there was a lot of attraction between the three of us. But I don't know that we ever found the right groove of it. Like, I think we just kind of kept fooling around because it... I don't know why, actually. We just kind of kept fooling around, all of us together. And I realized later that I was like, what did I want from that? And it was like, I wanted the emotional support of my gay friend who is a lovely, lovely person and a really good friend of mine, and very, very kind. Well, with the rock hard cock of the emotionally unavailable straight friend that I had. And I was like, I just needed them to be one dude, really. Mm. It was like, I was like, I'll put these two people in this situation
one
where
I'm very confused here. Very confused.
That makes so much sense, though.
And even later, so that straight friend of mine who still identifies as straight, even though he's gone on to have many more bisexual encounters with men, still totally. It's that funny thing, I think, for like he can't get past the shame of really liking men. And so he's never been able to like kind of move past. The last time I talked to him, he was like able to use the word bisexual sort of, you know, as an aside, like, well, maybe I am. I don't know. Who can say? It's a spectrum. But that was like the first time. And that was like 10 years after we had fooled around, you know, and was able to be like, well, you know, I've done some things with guys since, but that doesn't make me bi. I mean, maybe it does. Who knows? But yeah, it was a disaster. It was just really... really not fun.
And he knew that going in that the your friend was gay and that was attracted to him, because that seems like
so my friend at the time had identified more as bisexual and had been more like, and that's part of the reason I took it so personally, is because he had been like, I'm bisexual. He is now gay and I would identify fully as
that
gay.
That makes sense.
So yeah.
Well, that story, I think, perfectly illustrates this the problem with identity politics. Like, identity politics has given us a lot in terms of like, okay, now we have a vocabulary to discuss the nuances of how unique everyone is and like what a range there is, what a rainbow we are. But then when people stop using the words to accurately describe the variety of things and start using them to narrow, you know, who we are categorically, and they're like attached to a label, then it just becomes a clusterfuck, you know?
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, and I really felt for my straight friend in that, because I think that's can be a very confusing thing to, in, you know how they say like your disgust factor goes way down when you're aroused, and then later when you're not aroused you're like, oh, what was that, did I just masturbate to a cartoon, you know? Like you're like, what just happened? And I think that was like, in the moment he was really turned on by the bisexuality of everything, and then afterward it was like all of this inherent shame just really settled on him and he felt really awful, you know? So
interesting.
Yeah, but he also was grappling with it in the moment.
Yeah, like he was saying stuff, you know, in the moment and stuff. But afterward, when we all sat down and sort of like tried to post-mortem it and be like, what happened there? That wasn't.
Cup of coffee.
Yeah. It was very awkward.
That movie was interesting.
Did he apologize? Did he recognize, like, whoa, I was like slut-shaming you guys hypocritically?
No, I don't know that he ever apologized. Like I said about the emotional unavailability, like he's not a guy with a lot of emotional depth, very sexy person, but not the kind of person who's like very self-aware. So even being like, hey, you know, you're not being very respectful in the moment. He's like, I don't know, maybe. I guess. I don't know.
That's awesome. That's I assume, a great impression of that person.
Yeah, it is.
Of so many people, let's face it, of so many quote-unquote straight guys.
Yeah.
You know, where there is like anxiety even in bed of, am I allowed to only pay attention to how I feel right now? Does it feel good or not? Like, it's a pretty simple yes or no. And if it's no, well, then, okay, then like, what do I want to change? Instead, like, I don't know. I feel like we're all shepherded to be like, does this like reinforce my brand of who I am and what labels I've chosen that I feel comfortable with or are rewarded for having, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that was very, like he was hearing his whole wrestling team in the back of his head as he was getting his cock sucked by a man, being like, you know, just calling him names and stuff. And he was like, I like this. What does it mean?
You know? So essentially in his head, calling himself faggot.
Yeah,
in
totally.
His own mind.
Yeah. And not being able to just be like, even if that's true, that's fine. You know, not being able to work through it.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
I mean, to be fair, we were 25. You know, and so it's not like we had a ton of depth.
Yeah.
I mean, some people do. We sure didn't at 25 have the depth to be like, this is a real conversation about our identity. You know, we were just like, I don't know. That didn't work.
I wonder if there's some...
Maybe more alcohol.
Yeah.
Or ecstasy would probably have helped.
Yeah, probably.
Because then a little self-love would have led to a better...
Some guys have dick troubles with ecstasy, though.
Well...
I don't think impotence usually, but... Well, actually, that's not too much of a problem for a threesome if you just stay hard for a long time.
But more importantly, though, I think ecstasy is a great, like, sure path to just, like, self-acceptance.
Yeah,
the
like,
drug
oh,
does
kind of
okay trick you
everything.
Into that.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
I do wonder sometimes, like, obvious problems with homophobia and the whole, hey, faggot culture. But sometimes I feel this nervousness I wouldn't say straight or anything really for myself, but as a woman who's generally more attracted to men or wants like the romantic, like he like wants that romantic special bond with men in addition to the sex, like what if all guys were bisexual, would they forget about us, would they just you know would they just go down on each other like super well? I want to get in on that
anymore. Oh no.
No, but you know, like there's some baby part of female sexuality that wants to just like be worshipped in some special way. And maybe that is some type of dated probably, but social technology that males developed to be like, you know, don't get too into dicks,
yeah,
you know, because then, you know, then we all are going to have some larger problems. At least I think that might be an underlying fear, you know?
Wow.
What do you think? Am I off on one of my tangents?
No, I think it's interesting. I like the way that you think. I think it's cool.
Not to try to turn everything into evolutionary theory.
Well, it just takes it away from being so simple. It's like, oh, well, they're just afraid that they might be gay. It's like that. I feel like it makes sense that it's more complex than that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more at play there.
Right, because that doesn't answer the question of, well, what's so bad about being gay?
Yeah. I want to suck a dick just to piss my dad off at this point. I'm serious. And I want anal sex from a guy just to be like, it's not that big a deal. And I'm not attracted to men. I just don't think it's that big a deal. And I've thought about that a bunch. It's like, really? Why are we afraid of that thing? I know it would feel good to have my prostate stimulated. So why would that be so weird that a guy was doing it if I was safe? Why is that that weird?
So
it's
would
a fascination
you...
with that.
Would you feel okay with like, yeah.
And I just outed myself.
Yeah. So, I mean, would you be okay with that if you did it and discovered like, oh man, I'm never turning back?
I don't know. I guess I'm curious about that. I think it would just generally make me uncomfortable. I'd be like, okay, I'm glad I did that. That's okay. But yeah, I'm just not attracted to men. But I hate that there is like this knee jerk, like grossed outness about homosexuality. It's mm-hmm. like, why? Sex, it's not that different between two guys and a guy and a girl. Or two girls and a guy and a girl. It's not that different. It's not that more gross or anything.
Right.
It's weird. There's still the same activity. You're mashing genitals together and sucking and fucking. And it's just gross in general. Anyone having sex is gross for the same reasons.
It's all very sticky.
Yeah, it's all sticky and it's body fluids swapping. And you're not thinking about how you look if you're doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
And, I like also that for this, just to a testament to how terrible that threesome was, is that it beat out your molestation for a bad cock story.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes.
But I assume, let's hear your good cock story. I'm excited for it.
I decided to go with something sort of sweet. That I lost my virginity. I mean, I had a couple attempts because I had what's medically known as like serious hymen, where like you have like, it's not, it's actually, there's like a word for it, but like where your hymen is so thick. And mine, you know, like I kept trying to lose my virginity and I kept, and like, so I had things happen to me when I was younger, but either my hymen was still partway intact or something, or it just wasn't, because it was so serious, never properly torn or whatever. So I tried to have sex with a few different guys. I couldn't do it. Then finally, the guy that I lost my virginity to was this really sweet Mormon kid, and he was my boyfriend in the eighth or ninth grade. And he had the Mormon thing. I just feel like the thing with cocks is like, especially when you've had a lifetime of them, is like they all kind of blur together into one cock conglomerate. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't
archetypal cock.
Yeah, it's like you don't remember individual cocks. There's just like all these cocks. But I always have always remembered his cock. Like, I've always like, it's one that's burned in my mind in this weird way. Like, and it's so weird because, like, if you were like, what does your ex-husband's cock look like? I really can't picture it anymore. It's been 5 years. And I can kind of picture it, but, like, it's, like, vague. But, like, this cock, it's always in there. It's always... And it was because, so he had the Mormon thing of like, if you go to sex, if you have sex, you're going to go to hell. It's wrong. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of shame around it. So we would be fooling around and he was uncircumcised. So we had a foreskin. We would be fooling around. And I think that there's really nothing better than the foreplay that leads up to sex that you're not supposed to be having. Mm. Just the goddamn best. Like, it's so hot and so arousing. And so we would be fooling around, like, dry humping for an hour. Yeah. And then finally, like, okay, we can't take this anymore. So we'd strip down to our underpants, but no further. You have to just leave underwear on. And then we'd dry hump with underwear. And it was, like, that crazy hormonal, super hot, just, like, you're dying. And then finally be like, okay, well, what if one of us takes our underwear off? But no further yeah. than that. and I was like game. Like, I wanted to fuck so bad. But he, because of all his like religious upbringing stuff, like he was always like more reluctant. And so I would, every single time we'd have sex, have to go through this foreplay like game of like, well, what if we just kiss? Mm-hmm. Well, what if I just put my hand on your pants? Well, what if I just put it in your pants? And then we would go through this whole kind of cat and mouse thing where then finally at the end I would have, you know, we'd both be naked and I'd have him like right close to me and I'd be like, what if I just put you in a little bit? And he'd be like, no, we can't have sex. And I'd be like, just the tiniest, like just this much. And
just knock on the door.
And he had the perfect penis. Like, it was just beautiful and gorgeous. And I just remember like the sensation of finally, like after months of like this, you know, this dance, finally feeling him inside of me for the first time and just being like, Jesus, like it was just the best feeling in the world. Like, it was just, it was like the Hedwig and the Angry Inch, you know, the two bodies becoming one thing of like what you're supposed to feel like with a person. And it was because before that I had so many bad sexual experiences with bad people. And I had really mean, shitty, older, abusive boyfriends even before I had sex when I was like 12 and 13. I was dating like way older, dangerous guys. But he was my age and he was really a sweet Mormon kid. And so like, no, we shouldn't. And getting to be in control of the situation instead of having something forced on me was so different and so beautiful and like, and really kind of changed my sexuality in that time. And the sex was so bad too. Looking back, like I'd put him inside me and he would just blow immediately because he would just be like, oh my God. And then we'd be done. And I'd be like, yeah, high five. And he never, like, he didn't stimulate my clit. He didn't do anything. He didn't know about any of that. He never went down on me, but.
Did he have that Mormon thing that you keep talking about? Did he have that serious hymen-busting Mormon cock? Or
oh, yeah. He for sure did. He did.
That's what I thought you were saying.
He had a giant, beautiful, uncircumcised. It was a keeper. It was a piece.
So, wait, I just would love you to, for a minute, a lot of people don't actually understand what the hymen is. You seem like someone who's intimately, you know, knowledgeable. Yeah. Would you?
So the hymen is usually just this, like, thin flap of skin that covers, it's a little deeper in the vagina. I'm not sure how far. I think it maybe is like 2 inches in or so. It usually breaks naturally. It's just a little piece of skin that sort of seals the vagina closed weirdly, but it doesn't, usually it breaks naturally for girls. Like, it can happen during sports or you know while running or something, and it'll, but sometimes it doesn't. It's in some cultures very important, and like, they, before you can get married, they check your hymen to make sure you're still a virgin and stuff like that.
When
they would check to see if the sheet was bloody after the first time you had sex when you got married, that was wise, because the first time it hurts and you bleed. I don't know exactly why, but like, I basically had a very thick hymen that hadn't been broken all the way. So I bled and bled and bled and bled the first time I had sex. Mm-hmm. And it probably didn't help that I was like uptight and terrified of it anyway. So,
Right. But it's a membrane that doesn't, I mean, it doesn't like completely seal the canal. And that's why women can menstruate, like things can get from inside to outside.
Yeah, it's not like a Ziploc. Yeah. it's just a memory, and it can be different levels of thickness. Mine apparently was very, very thick. So, yeah. And that, it took several attempts. I had sex with like three people, tried to have sex with like three people who were, I'd be like, just keep going. And they'd be like, I can't get it in and I don't want to. And you're crying and please.
So if the typical hymen was the Marciano cherry, then yours is like the unripened black cherry.
Yeah. It was a bunch of cherries and yeah, it was pretty intense.
And then, so your Mormon boyfriend, like I've dated one Mormon. I got out kind of early. I dated one Mormon also, big, gorgeous cock, never went inside me. But when we fooled around, it was always, he was like kind of, we were both into it. And then after he would be like, all of a sudden I was the temptress and I needed to go talk to the bishop. And there was a lot of like his shame put on me as the person who precipitated things or enabled things. Did you get that from your...
No, and actually, he opened up this appetite for me for Mormon boys, so I continued to fuck Mormon boys like crazy.
They need
that.
It.
I was the scourge of the temple, for sure, and I, like, loved nothing more than, like, sweetly talking some Mormon boy into fucking me, like, it'll be fine. But maybe because I was non-Mormon, like, it was a given that I was a temptress, so they didn't put any, like, they never were, like, shameful or put anything, they often felt guilty afterward. I had a friend of mine who had, we were friends all the way through school, the whole time we were growing up, and he got cancer when we were teenagers, and he had to go through chemo, and he was like, I might die, and I don't want to die a virgin. Will you take my virginity? And I was like, fuck yeah.
Yes. Did he die?
No, he did not, because of my pussy, it turns out. It's the cure for cancer. I had sex with him, but afterward, he cried and cried, and he was like, no, I'm not going to get to heaven if I die of cancer.
Jesus.
I should have thought of that, ding dong.
I just like that they were, after sex with you, like, oh, she's from the realm of darkness. She can handle the shame. Yeah.
All women are.
Yeah. It was funny. At my high school reunion, my 10-year, I went and there were quite a few boys who had been married in the temple who should not have been because they had had sex with me who did not make eye contact with old Emma Arnold the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
And there were two guys who I had given a double hand job in the back seat of a car to at the same time once while we were driving up to go to rock climbing. Yes. And they avoided me like mercury. Like everywhere I went in the room, they both were like, no. They just stayed away from me the whole time. It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Shame is
so
a
I
weird
still
thing.
I still think it's weird because that feeling of like having, I mean, it's a hard thing to reproduce as an adult, you know, because like you don't have very many situations where like we shouldn't. Mm-hmm. But that has always been the closest I think I have come is like I was celibate for 90 days, no masturbation, no sex, nothing, just total celibacy for 90 days. And my boyfriend did it with me. And toward the end of that, I was like, we kind of allowed like a little kissing and stuff like that, but it had that same charge of like, we'd be kissing and I'd be like, well, I guess you can put your hand on my boob, you know? And cool. It felt like teenagers again, where we were so fired
that
up.
Sounds
and,
cool.
And when we finally had sex, it was mind blowing. Cause like you had waited so long and, so,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's
I'm
very
go,
interesting.
I feel like I should go fuck a Mormon now.
Yeah.
It's all sounding really good.
Well, yeah, I got a couple brothers.
And that was our conversation with comedian, mother, and former faux Mormon, Emma Arnold. Did you hear Zaylee there at the end? For shame, selling off your Mormon brothers. Well, they'd be happy with Emma, I'm sure. You really should check out Emma Arnold. She's been touring the country headlining. She also gets to open for acts like Ron Funches, Dana Gould. And you can follow her on her Twitter at IamARoadTrip. IamARoadTrip. Follow Emma Arnold. Check her out. Buy her album, Shut Up Calvin, on iTunes. She's fantastic. Thanks for tuning in. And if you like this episode, check out the other ones or write us in at badcock.com. Goodcock@gmail.com. Give us a little feedback.